You are Locked On Rockets, your daily podcast on the Houston Rockets, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
Welcome in, everybody, to a new episode of Locked On Rockets. I'm your host, Ben DuBose. As we chat on this Friday afternoon, Rockets are getting ready to take on the Memphis Grizzlies tonight. They're coming off a rare loss in Memphis on Wednesday evening that snapped the 9-game winning streak. But rather than focus too much on that one loss, which I think most of us know was a schedule loss, second night of a back-to-back, no Eric Gordon, no Clint Capella, there's a lot of reasons why that game went as it did. But with the Rockets now at 31-10 on the year, on pace for a 62-game season, well, we can say that because the Rockets are now exactly at the midpoint. So it's a good point to kind of get some big-picture perspective on where the Rockets are at with one half of the season in the books, the second half kicking off tonight. So for this show, I'm going to be joined by Eric Spyropoulos. He's writer for the Dream Shake, Hoops Habit, hosts his own podcast, the 94 Feet podcast. Eric, welcome back.
Hi, Ben. Thanks for having me again.
Sure thing. Eric, first and foremost, we'll start with that theme of, well, first half review. The Rockets are now 31-10. The on-pace percentage is obviously pretty easy to do at this point. But really, if you would ask even the most optimistic Rockets fans, which I think you and I are more optimistic than the general, or were going into this season, than the general consensus, but even for folks like us, I don't think we were expecting a team on pace to be a 60-plus win, top-three team in the Western Conference. Yet with half the season in the books, that's where the Rockets are. So just break down how have they done it and where they are as a franchise relative to your expectations just 2 or 3 months ago.
Yeah, like you said, you know, you and I were both pretty optimistic. Coming before the season started, I thought that the Rockets would win 50 games and, you know, be that, you know, 4 or 5 seed. Of course, they're above those you know, expectations and above that pace right now. And a couple of things I've been really surprised about. I've been surprised by the Rockets' defense. So, you know, defense struggled to start the season, but then they had an incredible December. Of course, they went 15-2 in that month. They posted a defensive rating of 103, and with their great offensive rating of 115.4, that was a net rating of 12.5, which is just absolutely spectacular. The Rockets have basically been around league average on defense. I think they're 19th right now, but, you know, I think on Wednesday they were 15th going into that Timberwolves game. So they've pretty much been league average on defense. They had that top 5 defensive month in December. And, you know, a lot of mainstream media were, you know, when they talked about the Rockets and before the season started, they just said, oh, they're going to have a bottom 10 defense. They'll barely make the playoffs. Well, you know, Rockets fans that had actually paid attention to the team knew that with just more effort, they could be a better defensive team than they were last year when the effort was severely lacking. So the defense has been a nice surprise. And then the offseason additions have fit in so seamlessly. It's been beautiful to watch Eric Gordon lead the bench unit as sixth man. I believe he's comfortably the front runner for sixth man of the year. Ryan Anderson has fit in. While he may not be, you know, scoring as well as you would want for a guy you're paying $20 million, you also have to keep in mind that one of the biggest aspects of Anderson's game is how far he stretches the court. I mean, him and Gordon both stand, you know, 2 to 3 feet behind the three-point line, which just adds so much more space for Harden's or, you know, Gordon's if he's ball handling their drives to the rim, which, you know, increasingly opens the Rockets' offense up. And both of them have been, you know, while not great defensively, Gordon, I think, has been solid enough defensively. And at least, you know, you can see some good effort from Anderson from time to time. You know, he obviously has athletic liabilities and, you know, limitations. But, you know, at least he gives effort, which is more than you can say for a bunch of the Rockets players last year. So those are, you know, kind of the key surprises that have taken me, along with the 2015 draft class, Harrell and Decker both being very good contributors in the rotation already this fast in their careers. So those are kind of the key surprises and takeaways so far for me.
Sure. And when you talk about some of the big picture data, where the Rockets are offensively and defensively, if they're a mid-tier defensive team, I don't see much in the Rockets' profile that indicates that any of this is fluky. Because if the Rockets are an elite offense, which we knew going into the year they had a good chance of being, and they've been pretty damn close to that, if you're looking at a top five offensive team, and again, if you listen to Mike D'Antoni, it's clear that he thinks the Rockets have actually a lot more upside on offense because they're still not playing quite at the pace that you would see typically from the 7 seconds or less offense. So he thinks there's still a lot more room to grow for them offensively to get even better. But basically, if the Rockets have a top five offense, elite on that end, and then they're middle in the pack defensively, it's not a stretch at all to see this as a 60-win team. And, of course, those defensive figures, those include the first 3 weeks of the year when there was no Pat Beverly. And ever since the end of November when you've had Beverly, they've really been close to, I'd say, top 12 in the league consistently on the defensive end.
Yeah, I actually remember tweeting this out, you know, shortly after the Rockets hired D'Antoni in the summer. I tweeted out a picture of D'Antoni's you know, past teams that he's coached and where they were in defensive rating, because of course defensive rating adjusts for pace, which is extremely important when you're analyzing a Mike D'Antoni coached team to analyze how good they were defensively. And I tweeted something about, you know, most of his teams were basically league average, anywhere from 15 to 18 on defense. And you know, I said that if the Rockets have a top three offense and a similar defense around league average, they can be an elite team. And this is exactly what they're doing right now this season.
Yep. And you look at the success of the Rockets on, well, defense, but offense as well. Obviously, it starts with Mike D'Antoni, but the other key piece is James Harden. And we've spent a lot of the first few minutes on this podcast talking about the surprises, how well Eric Gordon and Ryan Anderson, the shiny new objects, have fit in. We touched briefly on Sam Dekker and Montrezl Harrell stepping into bigger roles. But obviously, the straw that stirs the drink for the Rockets is James Harden, especially on offense, but defensively, he's been better than expected as well. And with the season at the halfway point now, to me, it's pretty clear that he's the MVP of the NBA. Because for the Rockets to be doing what they're doing, again, the metrics show you that it's not really fluky. If you have a defense in the middle of the pack, as you were saying, it profiles very similarly to those Suns teams in Phoenix, which were 55-plus every year, even in a tougher Western Conference than the one that exists today. But for the Rockets to win 55, 60-plus games in today's NBA with no other elite player other than James Harden, and we're talking about an NBA where obviously Durant has Stephen Curry, Klay Thompson, Draymond, LeBron has Kyrie and Kevin Love, etc., etc., to me, it's pretty clear that given the separation between the Rockets and Oklahoma City Thunder in the standings, James Harden has to be your MVP at the midway point. Curious your thoughts.
Oh, yeah, I mean, I've argued this issue so many times on my own podcast, the 93 Report, and, you know, I've basically done monthly award update episodes, and each time I say it's James Harden, especially in the last one, just like you said, the difference between the Rockets and the Thunder is so significant that it overrides Russell Westbrook averaging a triple-double. Not going to take anything away from Westbrook. He's having a spectacular season, of course. But the fact that the Thunder, I think, are only on pace for 48 wins last time I checked, while the Rockets are on pace for 62 wins, is more important than, you know, the 1.7 rebounds per game that Harden is away from averaging a triple-double. Because if Harden was averaging a triple-double right now, no one would be even arguing MVP, because that's the main argument people use for Russell Westbrook, is that he's averaging a triple-double. So I think Harden's definitely MVP. Of course, he's made a huge jump in the assist total. He's changed positions and done it just seamlessly, really. I mean, It's just spectacular how quickly he's become adjusted to playing point guard in this system. And he has to be MVP. And one other thing I want to mention about this topic that is really frustrating me recently is this new argument that has come up, because, of course, people who are defending Westbrook for MVP have to come up with new arguments as the Rockets keep winning. It's the argument that Harden has a significantly better surrounding cast than Westbrook in Oklahoma City. I think that argument is true to a very, very small extent, in the fact that the Rockets and Daryl Morey have done a better job of building around Harden than Oklahoma City has done building around Westbrook. I actually saw it yesterday on Colin Cowherd's show with Jason Whitlock that it was Chris Broussard, actually, who said that Harden is easier to build around.
Yes.
And that's a very good point. You put him with some shooters, Eric Gordon, Ryan Anderson, Trevor Reeves, and Patrick Beverley, some defensive-minded players around Harden, you've got this team that's on pace for 62 wins. But to say that the Rockets have a significantly better surrounding cast around Harden that is worth about 12 to 13 more wins, I don't buy that at all, especially because there is no other All-Star next to Harden at all. He is making these guys better.
Yep, and I thought Chris hit the nail on the head in terms of how to build around them, because Harden's game is so versatile that you can put a very diverse set of characters around him and still succeed. You know, you look at the team from 2 years ago when he was at MVP level, voted MVP by his peers, the players in the league, and that team was so different than this one. That team, obviously, Dwight Howard, Donatas Moniunis inside, you had a lot more, traditional style, I would say. Now, of course, they still shot a lot of threes. This is Daryl Morey's team, but that team was a lot more traditional. This team, of course, is classic Mike D'Antoni, and so to have basically two MVP years out of three from James Harden with a supporting cast and a style that's so different, I think that shows you why he's a guy that is pretty easy to build around. Whereas Russell Westbrook, it's no disrespect to him, because clearly he's having an amazing statistical season, but it is difficult to build around someone that has that level of ball dominance. So Harden's willingness as a distributor, the style with which he plays, I thought Chris absolutely hit the nail on the head with those comments, and I agree with you and him wholeheartedly. Now, right now, we're speaking with Eric Spyropoulos, writer for The Dream Shake. If you're not following him on Twitter, you can at Eric Spyroz. We've been spending the first 10 minutes or so of this show on a lot of macro issues, which is the first half review, what we've seen from Mike D'Antoni, James Harden, the Rockets as a whole. For the back half of this show, I do want to kind of turn it to the micro and some of the, you know, shorter-term trends that we've noticed over the last week or so. Now, we're taping this on Friday afternoon, Rockets getting ready for Memphis on Friday night, and then they head out on the road for a couple of games early next week, have another 5-7 night stretch, so you could have, unfortunately, another schedule loss or two, just as you did Wednesday in Minnesota. But when you look at what we've seen from the Rockets lately, one thing that kind of, I don't know if concern is the right word, but bothers me, they've gotten off to a lot of really slow starts. I tweeted out a stat the other night, the Minnesota game, that they had gotten off that they had trailed after the first quarter in 5 of their last 6 games, also had deficits of 10 or more points in 5 of the last 6. Now, until the Minnesota game, obviously they had won them all, as evidenced by the 9-game winning streak. Minnesota, it finally caught up with them. So I'm just curious, what are you seeing from them in the first half, especially the first quarter of games? Why have they started getting off to slower starts, and how do they fix it?
Yeah, this has been increasingly a bit of a concern. Not going to say it's a major big concern, because it's certainly something you can fix. It's a lot easier to fix than, you know, a team like the Wolves, who just beat the Rockets, who, you know, so far in their first half of the season have been just getting killed in third and fourth quarters. That's something I think is a lot harder to fix than, you know, starting off strong. A couple of things I've noticed. Of course, the past 2 games, they missed Eric Gordon, so when they went to the bench in the first quarter, they didn't get that spark. I think that's a significant thing, at least for the past 2 games. And then recently over the past, you know, going back to that the Orlando game, the Rockets have been cold shooting-wise to start the game, and then, you know, they eventually, because they shoot so much, they're going to snap out of a mini slump and, you know, hit a couple of threes. And that was a big reason they won in Toronto. And then, of course, you know, against Charlotte, they, you know, had that huge lead, and they choked it, but then they were able to come back. So the shooting concerns, and then, of course, the lack of Eric Gordon, missing Eric Gordon for the past 2 games is kind of 2 big things I've noticed. We'll see what happens tonight against Memphis when with Gordon back and seeing if they can snap that cold funk. But the thing I want to notice about, you know, coming from behind is that, you know, last season, of course, they had that nightmare year, but last season they too often would get down early in games, and then that team would just check out. You know, the chemistry issues, just the lack of, you know, motivation and hustle and, you know, effort and wanting to play the games. They would just check out once they got a big deficit, like in the first or second quarter. The true difference this year is that this team is not only willing to come back and fight for that comeback, but, you know, I think that their 3-point shooting, now that they have actual good shooters around Harden, provides the easiest way to come back in a game. I mean, you can be down 15. Next thing you know, you make 2 stops, you hit a couple of threes, because we know Anderson and Gordon can just get hot whenever. And then you've got Harden taking over. And next thing you know, in 2 minutes, you cut the deficit from 15 to 4. I mean, that's just the great thing about being such a great 3-point shooting team. But there are some concerns about kind of a general, you know, lack of, I don't want to say kind of, you know, urgency in the first quarter, but there is something missing, and maybe it's Eric Gordon the past two games, but or maybe it's just cold shooting over the past week, because, you know, jump shooting teams can get cold. But, you know, in the end, I think that this is something that will be fixed shortly, and if not, I don't think it's a huge concern moving forward, because it can be fixed with, you know, a good locker room and some good shooters.
Sure, and one thing that we didn't touch on was the health of Pat Beverly. That's something that I wonder about a little bit, because I know he came back from the wrist injury against Oklahoma City, played pretty well, or at least shot well, those first two games against Oklahoma City and Orlando. But we talked to him this week, said the wrist isn't feeling any better at all. Last three games, he's shooting just 16% from three, I think. And what really stood out to me more, I saw someone on Twitter say towards the end of the Minnesota game that it looked like it was increasingly uncomfortable for Beverly to even touch the basketball. Like, he was not the facilitator that we've seen him be in the past. And of course, every time Pat Beverly has any injury at all, there's a segment of Rockets Twitter that panics and says, oh, he's going to need surgery or something like that. I'm not saying that by any stretch of the imagination, but I do wonder, you know, it's too short of a, you know, sample size to really panic now. We're talking about just three games, and even if the guy's fully healthy, he's going to have three games over the course of the year that he just doesn't shoot or doesn't play that well. It happens. And I don't think it's a surgical thing, but what I wonder, kind of keeping in the back of my mind, is it going to come to a point where the Rockets realize, hey, we've got to shut him down for a week or two to make sure they get that wrist right? I'm curious what you've, you know, seen from him the last 3 days, and if it's just a matter of, or three games, I should say, and if it's just a matter of, well, he's missing shots, or if he looks a little bit tentative in general.
Yeah, it was interesting, because when he first came back from the injury, he played well against Oklahoma City, shot pretty well, and, you know, obviously after that game he said it hurts, I think his quote was, it hurts like hell to shoot the ball and basically, you know, to touch the ball. But he kept playing, you know, kept providing that solid defense. But then, yeah, I watched that Minnesota game, and he just looked so uncomfortable out there. I kind of felt bad for him having to play through the injury. And there was an article we posted on the Dream Shake today. I think it was by Josh Reese, who was basically talking about how, you know, Beverly will play through the injury. That's kind of who he is as a player. That kind of that's his attitude towards the game. But, you know, long term, that could be a concern. As you said, yeah, I think it would be preferable to shut him down. You know, if they realize by the end of next week that, you know, he's continuing to play poorly and, you know, he's complaining, you know, that about the pain, you might as well shut him down for a week or two in January. You've got to make sure he's there for the playoffs. You don't want to have that kind of scenario like they did 2 years ago when, you know, he had to get shut down for the playoffs. So you've got to hope that, you know, if they realize that it's going to be a real problem, shut him down now rather than, you know, have him play through the regular season only to miss the playoffs, because the Rockets are pretty comfortably in that third seed. They don't need to fight, you know, chew and claw for seeding as of right now.
Sure. So. And, of course, the upside is that tonight against Memphis, they are going to get Eric Gordon back. I could see a scenario where maybe the Rockets were considering resting Beverly, but with Gordon out with the sprained toe, it wasn't really the time to do it, because you just, quite frankly, wouldn't have enough bodies. Now with Gordon back, if you do need to rest Beverly, at least it gives you a little bit of insulation, just another guy who can eat some of those minutes. And of course, that's, you know, the least of Eric Gordon's contributions, because obviously he's a heck of an elite player in his own right. You spoke a few moments ago about kind of the psychological effect of the Rockets never being out of a game because they can shoot threes. I've had guys on this podcast before who break down how it's just so demoralizing for the opposition. The flip side of it, you have these guys like Gordon and Anderson, and I think it's incredibly uplifting for the Rockets as well, because as you were saying, all it takes is a couple of possessions, maybe 90 seconds of game action, and you can turn a 13-15 point deficit back to four. It happens so quickly. So I think because of that, there's not really any panic. And of course, the ringleader for that mentality is Eric Gordon, because he can put up so many points so quickly. I know he's missed the last two games with a sprained toe, still got a little bit of soreness, but he'll be back tonight. You had a great article about a week ago on Hoops Habit about basically his resurgence, his comeback year. People can easily find that on your Twitter at Eric Spiroz. But just talk a little bit more about kind of the evolution of his game this year. We all know he's a great shooter, but one thing I loved in your piece, you talked about him developing as a playmaker as well, because it seemed like, you know, this month he hasn't even shot that well from three, but yet when he's played, he's still made a huge contribution to this team because of just how valuable of an overall playmaker that he is.
Yeah, that's the thing I've really enjoyed from watching Eric Gordon's season. Obviously, the shooting has been spectacular. Just kind of ironically, ever since I posted that article, he's only shot 25.7% from three-point land. So hopefully that doesn't coincide with the article and he can come back tonight and shoot well from beyond the arc. But we know he's a great scorer. That's basically the thing he's been known to do over the the course of his career. And the reason why I kind of called it, I titled the article "The Resurgence of Eric Gordon" is because he seems like a forgotten player. Mm-hmm. He was, even his free agency signing with the Rockets this past summer was overshadowed because I think it was only a couple hours before they signed Anderson to a bigger contract that got more attention because of the monetary value to it. But a lot of people on Rockets Twitter were extremely excited about this kind of under-the-radar Eric Gordon signing, and it looks like an extremely reasonable contract now in today's kind of cap situation. But yeah, as you mentioned, the playmaking not only has been nice to watch, but also important because, he's not a starter anymore. He is leading that bench unit with, Patrick Beverley staggering the minutes, and therefore becomes the focal point of the bench unit. So him, just becoming somewhat of a threat as a playmaker and passer is extremely important because he's that focal point on the bench unit. And I mentioned in the article, in December he increased, his assist rate to 3.4 per game, which is pretty solid for a shooting guard that's not really known as a playmaker. Mm. It's kind of coincided with an increase in usage percentage, which is a good sign. He's not just, taking that increase in usage percentage just to shoot more. He's actually taking that increase in usage percentage to pass more and get his teammates more involved. He's a great driver to the rim. He's pretty good in the pick and roll, obviously great as a spot-up shooter. But that increase and improvement as a playmaker is extremely important now that he's a focal point of a bench unit and kind of has to create the offense when James Harden is off the floor. And then when Harden comes back, Gordon can be a secondary player and predominantly a shooter beyond the arc. So it's been great to see him improve as a playmaker. It's been extremely important and a big reason for the Rockets' bench success is because of that, I think.
Sure, and to tie into one of your earlier points, I actually think that's more evidence of why Harden is a more versatile player and easier to build around than, say, Russell Westbrook, because it's not easy to have two perimeter shooting guards, basically. I know Harden's a point guard in name in this system, but he's the player he's always been, and it's not easy to have a second perimeter playmaker take on the role that Eric Gordon has done, but because of Harden's willingness to share the ball, it's worked here. And I'm not going to say Oklahoma City specifically. I think there are a lot of situations where with an established perimeter creator, it would not be as easy to integrate Eric Gordon as it was here. So I think some of his success certainly is a testament to James Harden's mentality. Beyond that, of course, a lot of it's just Eric Gordon's individual ability. And, you did a good job of breaking down how he's doing it, not just as a shooter, as a playmaker. One thing I've asked a lot of my guests on this show, and I'll give you the same kind of query, who is the Rockets' second best player? Because to me, there are a lot of ways you could go. Obviously, Capella, when he's healthy, gives them a presence in the middle that no one else does. Montrezl Harrell is just not tall enough, and Nene does not have the athleticism. Trevor Ariza, of course, is immensely valuable as a 3-and-D player. He's given them so many, not just defensive contributions, but just minutes. He's played 42, 44 minutes when the Rockets are in a tight spot. You can stretch Trevor Ariza out. Definition of a pro. But my contention is that even though, Ariza might be the second most valuable player from a standpoint of what he gives you, but I would actually say that Gordon, to me, is the second most important player because the skills he has are so difficult to replicate. And I think we've seen that in his absence the last 2 days. It's like, with Capella out, you can replace that to an extent with Montrezl Harrell's athleticism. I know he's not the same lob finisher, but Montrezl can give you some of those skills. If Trevor Ariza went out, you could replace some of his skills. Obviously, Pat Beverley can D up on the perimeter. You could also conceivably throw in Corey Brewer or KJ McDaniels. But the traits that Eric Gordon has are just really tough to replace. So as I see it, there's a lot of guys you could argue for who's most valuable, but to me, Gordon is the second most important for this particular team.
Yeah, when Capella went down, kind of around that time, and the Rockets, I think they went like 2-1 in the first 3 games without Capella.
1-2, actually.
They won. They lost Spurs and Grizzlies. Yep. At that time, I comfortably thought that it went Harden number 1, Capella number 2, and then you know, Gordon number three. You know, we saw the past two games with Gordon out, the Rockets have really struggled, got off to slow starts. And, you know, in the past, you know, before when Gordon was playing and they got off to a slow start, you know, Gordon would come in and almost completely, almost erase that slow start because of the energy and his abilities. And the Rockets have been, you know, comfortably riding the ship without Capella. Of course, Harrell has been really good, especially on the offensive end. I mean, he's shooting an insane percentage over the past, you know, week. Finishing lobs, of course, he doesn't provide you the rebounding and rim protection that Capella does. But right now, I would say that Gordon is number two. And another, you know, reason why I think that is because he is such a perfect fit next to James Harden. As I just mentioned, he's the focal point of the bench unit, and, you know, the Rockets bench has been very good, mainly because of how good Gordon has been, especially as a playmaker and shooter. And then you bring in Harden, and Gordon seems just as comfortable playing off the ball, which is extremely important, playing next to James Harden. It's a big reason why Patrick Beverley is a great fit next to James Harden as well. Also a reason why Ty Lawson wasn't a great fit, or Jeremy Lin, for that matter, weren't great fits next to Harden, because they could not play off the ball. Gordon can have the ball in his hand and play make a little bit, and then Harden comes in and Gordon can be just as comfortable playing off the ball and shooting from beyond the arc and, you know, catching and driving to the rim and stuff like that. So I agree that Gordon has, in my opinion, leaked Capella as the second most important player for the Rockets. I think Capella's third because I think he provides a great, you know, first of all, he has great chemistry with Harden in pick and roll, and provides rim protection that is extremely important. You know, every team needs to have that kind of good rim protector. So I'd say it goes Harden, Gordon, Capella now. And then, of course, Beverley and Ariza are really right in there for the mix because they just have a real presence in the locker room. And, of course, you know, kind of both ends of the floor are making significant contributions.
Yeah, I know they played extremely well without Capella. It just coincided when the Rockets were really hitting their stride was when Clint went out with the broken fibula. So I don't think it's a matter of him not being important. Obviously, it's just they're just playing really great basketball as a team, and that's how they were able to largely withstand it. They still probably have about one more week to go until Clint gets back. But I did think about Clint the last couple of games, because when they get off to slow starts, I can think of so many games through the first 6 weeks of this year when that Harden-Capella pick and roll was the way to kind of unlock the opposing defense early in the game. If they weren't making shots, that was something that when the shooting was cold, they could buy a little bit of time to kind of tide them over. Whereas now you don't really have that game. So, yeah, Gordon's second most important, but certainly you can make a pretty good argument for Capella as well, based on, well, what you said, but also some of the trends we're seeing, especially early in the first and third quarters during this recent stretch where the Rockets have found themselves behind in a lot of games. Eric, very last question for you, and it's kind of tied into the other one, which is, if the Rockets further bolster their team, the trade deadline's in just over a month in mid-February, what do you think they do, or what should they do? And by and large, you know, we've heard a case for another big. We know they almost signed Giannis Antetokounmpo. There's been rumors of them and Kostas Koufos. But when I look at what's happened the past week, I wonder about the need for a shooter. Because when Eric Gordon went out, obviously exposed they were a little bit thin there. We know earlier this week we heard from Calvin Watkins of ESPN that they were poking around Mike Dunleavy. So I'm just curious, if they make a move, and I'm assuming it's not going to be a big one because I can't imagine them breaking up the core of this team right now, curious what you think the move, A, would be, and B, what it should be.
Yeah, this is actually interesting. I just recorded a podcast and posted it today with Duncan Smith, and we talked about this exact topic of, you know, the Rockets possibly making a move, and I think both it should be and it will be a trade for a wing that can shoot. And we talked about it. I think that it's really significant because almost every game I see Corey Brewer have two to three open corner threes that he just cannot hit. You know, threes that could, you know, change the momentum if they're down or increase the lead if they're up. And so I think that replacing, you know, Brewer's minutes somehow, I know that he's been a big factor in the locker room. And it's been, you know, well spoken about by the coaches and the players. But on the court, I think if you can replace Brewer, and the player that I really thought would be a great fit would be Tabo Cephalosha from the Hawks, who have, of course, already traded Korver. You know, were rumored to trade Millsap, but then took him off the market as they started winning games. But Cephalosha will be a free agent at the end of the season, so the Hawks were probably still looking for something, a young player and a pick for Cephalosha, some kind of value back. And Sefolosha is a 3-and-D wing. He provides great defense. I think he, last time I checked, I think he was first in small forwards in defensive real plus-minus. I think he shoots a three around 30 to 32% this season, which is better than Corey Brewer's. And if you can imagine just fitting Sefolosha in that corner where he can hit those threes on a little bit more consistent basis. And then, of course, he provides, you know, better defense than Brewer, you know, does at this point. So I think that making a trade for a kind of quote-unquote 3-and-D wing, even though those are really kind of valuable and, you know, very limited around the league, but Sefolosha could fit that kind of criteria. You can somehow, if Morey can somehow make a trade for a guy like Sefolosha to just fill in instead of Corey Brewer, I think that makes the bench unit even that more dangerous, and then gives you another defender for late-in-game situations, like if they play the Warriors, that can, you can throw out Beverly, Harden, Sefolosha, Ariza, and then Capella, if he's healthy, and that's a really good defensive lineup that doesn't really sacrifice too much offensively. So I say the real goal, and I think this is what Daryl Morey's thinking as well, it should be a 3-and-D wing, and the guy I would target would be Sefolosha from the Hawks.
Yeah, I'm starting to lean that direction as well. I know they flirted with a lot of bigs, but you have to think back. When they were in serious discussions with Demo and all that stuff went down, that was early to mid-December. We've since had over a full month of consistent play for Montrezl Harrell. He's played really over 25 minutes a night since Capella's injury. And I think it's pretty clear that Montrez is giving them probably more than the Rockets were expecting when they targeted earlier in the year. You know, you could kind of see them looking for one more big. I think now Harrell has played well enough that while I'm not going to say that they would not trade for another big, I think it's not as much of a clear need. Whereas a shooter to potentially take some of those minutes from Corey Brewer, it seems like a little bit higher in the pecking order now that you know you have Montrezl Harrell able to take some of those minutes on the interior. Eric, thank you so much for the time and joining us again. Why don't you toss out before you leave your Twitter handle, your podcast, basically where anybody can find your work that's not already following you?
You can find me on Twitter at Eric Spiros, just a shortened version of my last name. I host my own NBA podcast, the 94 Feet Report Basketball Podcast, and you can follow that on Twitter, or you can just find the links for my Twitter. And then I write for the Dream Chick on SB Nation and for Hoops Habit on FanSided. So that's where you can check out my work.
Excellent. Eric, thank you so much for the time. We'll be checking with you again soon, okay?
All right, Ben. Thanks for having me.
Sure thing. That's Eric Spiropoulos of the Dream Shake and Hoops Habit. Thanks to him for the time. Thought he had a lot of great points, but I thought his last one, I love the name Thabo Sefolosha, and increasingly every game that passes where you see more consistent play for Montrezl Harrell and, well, more missed corner threes from Corey Brewer, it hardens my opinion more and more that another wing is a direction where if they can make one more move, that's where you go. I do think that another defensive-oriented big would help if you can get it, but I just don't see it being the first priority. Now, the tricky thing, it was reported by Mark Stein of ESPN today in his Friday column at ESPN.com that it seems like KJ McDaniels, not Corey Brewer, is the more likely Rocket to leave at the trade deadline. And it's kind of tricky because KJ McDaniels' upside scenario is as a 3-and-D wing, and he's not there yet. So it's kind of tricky to say, well, can the Rockets acquire someone that would fit a, you know, play now mode at the wing position while giving up someone basically of the same skill set that's not there yet. It's not going to be easy, but what you have to hope, and Atlanta might be a good template, is that someone's willing to basically sacrifice present for future, basically trade the Rockets a little more stability. Sefolosha is a good example, but I'm sure there's others as well, for the sake of having KJ McDaniels and his theoretical upside as a guy who, of course, he signed on a reasonable contract through last season. And so a team that's not going to win a title this year, maybe they're willing to take a little bit of a hit in the presence and hope to develop McDaniels into something bigger down the road. Now, obviously, the Rockets would like to develop McDaniels themselves in a perfect world. But in reality, I don't know if the Rockets can sit on a chip like that with a season that's this good. Team that right now is a 62-20 team, I don't know that you have the luxury of not cashing in your chips. I think they want to be a little more aggressive in the present. The season obviously dictates that. And if Corey Brewer is too tough to move, which on an $8 million plus contract with another season guaranteed after this one, he might be, then KJ McDaniels obviously becomes your leading chip. It wouldn't necessarily be an easy move with getting a player of the same position and some of the same skill sets. But I do think it can work because there are a lot of teams around the NBA, Atlanta being one example, that clearly have accepted that, you know what, 2017, this is not the year for us. So maybe the Rockets can, it may take a few more weeks, but maybe they can find a team that's willing to take that kind of trade-off. The only unfortunate thing is that, well, when you're looking at those dynamics, you have to have a team that's willing to kind of admit they're out of the race to do it. But I don't know, maybe it won't take that long because Atlanta has obviously already done that to an extent with the Kyle Korver move. So with the bar as high as it is these days with teams like Golden State and Cleveland, maybe you will see a slightly more active January trade market because in theory, it's a lot easier for teams to admit they're out of the race than it would be if the top wasn't so damn tough to get to. Anyway, appreciate all you guys for listening. Appreciate Eric for stopping by. Again, I'm Ben Dubose, writer for Sports Talk 790. Follow my work there at sports790.com. Follow my work on Twitter, simply at Ben Dubose. This is Locked On Rockets, your home for daily podcast coverage of the Houston Rockets. Follow us on Twitter at Locked On Rockets. You can email us at lockedonrockets@gmail.com if you've got questions, suggestions, whatever it may be. You can also subscribe to us at iTunes, Stitcher, Audio Boom, Google Play, wherever you go to subscribe to your media, just search for Locked On Rockets and you can find us. For now, I will get ready to go to Toyota Center for tonight's game. I'll be talking with you on Twitter from Toyota Center as the Rockets take on the Grizzlies. And then tomorrow, of course, is a day off for the Rockets, but, well, it's not for the Texans, who have a huge second-round playoff game against the New England Patriots. If you're not already following Locked On Texans, that's hosted by my buddy Robert Land on this same Locked On Podcast Network. Please do so. He's going to have lots of coverage of Texans-Patriots. Just search for Locked On Texans, the same place that you can find Locked On Rockets, and Robert will have you covered for everything going on with the Texans as they get ready to take on the Patriots. And then, of course, early next week, Rockets back at it. They're going to have a big stretch of 5 games in 7 nights, including the Warriors next Friday night at home. That's going to be a massive game. So there's going to be a lot of Rockets stuff to discuss. So stay tuned here to Locked On Rockets. For now, I'll sign off and get ready for the game. Hope you guys enjoy your weekend, and I'll be talking with you again from Toyota Center in just a few hours.
Ace is the place with the helpful hardware, folks.
It's Ace's biggest LED light bulb sale of the year. Right now, buy one, get one free on our best-selling LED light bulbs. Our 4-pack of LED bulbs is $9.99, and our 2-pack of LED floodlights is only $12.99. Buy one, get one free. There's no limit on how much you can save, so stock up now. Hurry in. Buy one, get one free on long-lasting 10-year LED bulbs, now through Monday, only at your neighborhood Ace. See participating stores for details.